So welcome, Aaron, our very first podcast with All Together Now, a Beatle podcast. Are you excited?
I am excited. And it's a little different doing your own podcast. And I admit I'm a little amused. I'm sure the reaction of some people on hearing the announcement was, really? You really think that what the world needs is another Beatles podcast?
Well, you know, the feedback, I put a sort of stay tuned post on my Tumblr blog, and people were really excited and they were really looking forward to hearing from you. So, yeah. So there you go. They do want another podcast on the Beatles.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I'm sure that would have been my reaction if I were just a casual fan. I have no idea how many Beatles podcasts are out there. And there are already some very good book review podcasts. So I wanted to clarify on what it is we're trying to offer that's different from what's already available. Right. And really what we're going to try and do is, number one, we're going to try and keep things relatively concise. So our podcasts are going to be hopefully between 30 minutes to an hour. This one may run a little longer because it's the first one, and there are some elements that we're going to have to go over that we won't have to go over in subsequent podcasts. And also, the focus is really going to be the podcast equivalent of the book reviews I used to have on the website before I had two more children and ran out of uninterrupted time to write book reviews and analysis. So we're trying to provide the same level of analysis and experience that you would have if you were taking a graduate school level reading seminar on the Beatles. And for those of you who have never taken a reading seminar, I'll explain a little further what that entails, but let me clarify that this is my experience in history. I don't know how it works for other subjects and other disciplines, but at least as a history student in graduate school, you're required to take a certain level or a certain amount of seminar hours in order to graduate. And these are the classes that tend to be the most time intensive and also the ones that you have to study for the most. And in a reading seminar, it's a semester long class. So it's 16 weeks. And every week, except for maybe midterm and final, you are expected to read a new book. And it could be a 200-page book, and it could be a 900-page book. And you are entirely at the mercy of your professor as to what you are assigned. So you read this book, and every student in the class is reading a different book every single week. And then you are expected to come to class the next week, having read the book and written a 2 to 3 page analysis of it. And I'm using the word analysis deliberately because it's not a review and it's not a summary. Because this graduate school level class, the expectation from the professor from the moment you walk in the door is that you are familiar with historiography and that you are familiar with historical methods, and that you are going to apply those to the book that you read. So when you write that 2 to 3 page paper, you might have a paragraph that's basically summary and review, but the rest of it is looking at what are the historical strengths methodologically of this book? What are its weaknesses? Where does it stand on the major debates in its historiography? What is the reputation of its author? Does it introduce new primary source evidence? Does it introduce primary source evidence in a way that it argues for an entirely new narrative? All of these particular elements are what you're really supposed to pay attention to and include in your paper. So you write your paper and then you present it to the rest of the students. You usually have only about 6 to 15 students in a reading seminar because that's all it can handle. And 15 is pushing it. And so you go over your analysis and talk about your book, but because everyone else also has their own analysis of their own specific book, not only are you introduced to the material and the analysis in your book, you're introduced to the analysis of 6 to 12 to 15 different books every single week.
Wow.
So it's a really excellent way to immerse yourself in a subject's history and in its historiography, because you have roundtable discussions about, okay, what are areas of this historiography that have not been covered adequately? What primary source evidence is controversial? All of these particular elements. And it really, really helps, and I speak from experience, if you're interested in the subject.
Yeah.
Are not that interested in the subject. It is a semester-long slog, but you're just, you can only take what the course schedule offers. So I've taken reading seminars where I loved the subject, and I've taken reading seminars where I didn't, and there's a really big difference. But of course, we're jumping to the conclusion that anyone listening to this podcast is going to want to delve really deep into the
details. Right. Yeah, yeah. Great. So so that's sort of a quick introduction to the reading seminar approach. And does that kind of cover, do you think, kind of what we're going to be doing here? Or do we want to kind of frame that in a little bit more in terms of, we're not expecting our readers to necessarily read every book that we review, although they might want to when we're done.
I hadn't thought about that. Certainly, if they wanted to, it would be really interesting someday. I'd love to teach a graduate school level reading seminar on the Beatles. It would be interesting to do a Zoom version of that.
Yeah.
But would be sometime in the future when I had the time to do so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And get their sort of analysis and compare it to. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Is there any more words we need to say about that, Erin, or should we kind of talk a little bit about the book that we're going to be reviewing?
I think you can go ahead and introduce Du Neuer, because I think that's where we were going to go.
Okay. Okay. So the book we're reviewing is Conversations with McCartney by Paul Du Neuer. And just a little bit of information about the author. He was born in Liverpool. He's a Liverpudlian. He was born in 1954, so he's a few years older than me. He also lived in the same areas as Paul lived growing up. And he met Paul initially. Let me see here. He first saw him perform in 1973 at the Liverpool Empire Theater when he was about 19. Mm-hmm. And then in 79, when he was in his early 20s, he wrote his first article about Paul for New Musical Express, or NME, after he interviewed him backstage. And he noted in his book that it was interesting that NME sent its most inexperienced writer to interview Paul. So it was kind of fortuitous for him to go, but it was kind of an interesting choice on their part to send him.
Mm-hmm.
He also kind of makes the observation that being a Liverpudlian kind of facilitated the conversation with Paul, that he wasn't your typical kind of interviewer coming from a magazine and asking him questions, that they had a lot in common. And he often talked about how he was having a discussion with him, how the conversation would sort of veer off into talking about common sites in Liverpool and stores and that kind of thing. So it really did help the interview be a conversation, which is really important to Paul, apparently, that he didn't want it just to have a Q&A. He wanted to have a conversation. So that's Du Neuer. Du Neuer also, he began his career as a freelance rock journalist, and eventually wrote, of course, for NME, The Word, Q magazine. He was the founding editor of Mojo magazine. Mm-hmm. And he's written many books, mostly about the music scene, and one about the Liverpool music scene. And let's see what else about him. He describes his book. This is a quote from him. He says, "I've drawn together our scattered conversations from each of those encounters, interviews which span from 1979 to 2015, and reordered them into a single narrative." And he said his intention was to correct the imbalance he perceived with respect to the sort of relative inattention paid to Paul's career post Beatles. That's what he wanted to, the balance he wanted to correct. And he says part one of the book is roughly chronological and the second is thematic. And he said he sort of remixed the interviews and the conversations to improve continuity in his storyline. And the interviews were conducted in Paul's office or in his studio in Sussex. And interestingly, he also kind of became an employee of sorts with Paul, helping him with, as he describes, editorial projects, including tour brochures, press kits, album liner notes, etc. And he emphasizes that all the quotes in the books, in his book from Paul are direct quotes. And he said he wanted the book to showcase Paul speaking for himself. Do you have anything you want to add to that, Aaron, or comment on?
Back to the emphasis you were putting on of both of them being from Liverpool, that to me is of crucial importance, both in this particular instance with Paul Dunoyer and Paul McCartney, but also in history. Because when you have people who are from different cultures or different countries, you can have mistranslation. Cultural mistranslation, linguistic mistranslation, mm-hmm. and it can be perfectly incidental and accidental, mm-hmm. but it can still happen. And mm-hmm. you have individuals who are from the same hometown, then you aren't going to have instances like that. And in fact, I think we have a few interviews where, or at least one in this book, where Paul explicitly emphasizes that because Dunoyer is from Liverpool, mm-hmm. in this particular instance, I think he's talking about the lawsuit that he had to file against John, George, and Ringo. He says that Dunoyer understands the way, he doesn't explicitly say in a way that other people would not understand, but mm-hmm. emphasizes, you understand what that meant for my reputation being from Liverpool.
Right. Yeah.
So there's that element that you don't have an issue of mistranslation. And there's also an element that we see in other historical examples of being from the same area or the same hometown can simply get you a level of access that otherwise you would not get. And reviewers can let me know whether they appreciate my historical digressions or don't, but I'll give you an example. We have a book, and I'm trying to remember which book it was, I'd have to look it up, about World War II. And a few weeks following D-Day, you have an American private who shows up at the headquarters of General Dwight Eisenhower, who is the supreme Allied commander of forces in Europe. And this American private shows up and says, hey, I'd like to chat with Eisenhower for a little bit. And the guard at the front of the tent, well, yeah, you and, you know, the rest of the Western Hemisphere, bug off. You're a private. He's Supreme Allied Commander. Mm-hmm. And the private goes, tell him I'm from Abilene, Kansas. Mm-hmm. I'm Joe such and such from Abilene, Kansas. And Eisenhower was from Abilene. He grew up in Abilene until he left for West Point. And so the guard goes back to Eisenhower and says, Joe, somebody from Abilene, Kansas is here to chat with you. And Eisenhower is evidently thrilled. He goes, yeah, send him in. I'd love to talk with him. Mm-hmm. So for 15 to 20 minutes, Eisenhower, probably one of the busiest men on the face of the earth, mm-hmm. spends 20 minutes chatting with nobody just because they're from the same hometown.
Right. Yeah. And Dunoyer kind of emphasizes that in his book too, and he says, and I'm quoting here, family and Liverpool are recurrent words in conversations with McCartney. The two ideas are practically fused, and that growing up in Liverpool was, quote, a means to shore up the internal solidarity of the Beatles and their entourage. And everybody in their inner circle, you know, Brian, Mel, Neil, Derek Taylor, Tony Bramwell, Tony Barrow, Peter, everybody was from Liverpool. So that Dunoyer was very conscious of that, entering into these conversations with Paul McCartney, and notes that that is a recurrent theme throughout their conversations.
Right. I think it's a powerful element. And we've seen in Beatles history and historiography, when you have the subject of the interview from one area and the interviewer from another, that there can be cultural and linguistic mistranslations.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now that you've gone over the background of Du Neuer, and we've emphasized that that does play a key role, I was going to go over the categorizations of the
Sure.
book.
Sounds
and
good.
how that works is, again, if you're in that seminar class and you're writing that 2 to 3 page paper, this would be the information that you would include in about the second to third paragraph of your paper, of your analysis. So the first place you start is it a primary source or is it a secondary source? And the issue with Conversations with McCartney is that technically, because it's a biography, it's a secondary source. So if you're an historian or if you're a librarian, and I've been both, I don't have an MLS, but I worked in a library for quite a few years, you'd consider it a secondary source because it technically is a biography. But I'd say about half the material in it are Paul's interviews. And because those are interviews, those are primary sources. They're retrospective, but they're still primary sources. So it's a little more complex than just labeling it, okay, this is a secondary source.
So Erin, just to clarify, so the only way a book could be categorized as a primary source would be if it's an autobiography, like just off the top?
An autobiography would be a primary source. A memoir would be a primary source.
Okay.
Because you have Du Neuer framing it and offering the context.
Right. Okay.
That's really what pushes this over the edge. And again, I'm dealing with this just as much as a librarian, because you have to be able to catalog books in certain sections. So that's the first thing you do, is you look and see, is it a primary source or is it a secondary source, and what type of primary source or secondary source it is. But then the second element that you need to categorize with is chronology. And so how this works is you look first at the publication date. And so for this particular book, you're looking at 2015. Now, you can't stop there because it's tempting to, but there are some other areas that you have to address. In general, one of the things that you have to look at is not just the publication date of the edition that you are using, but in particular, the original publication date. If this is a re-edition or if it is a revised edition, then when that original publication date was matters immensely.
Yeah.
And we've seen this in Beatles historiography. I've used the example before on other podcasts. The Beatles Forever with Nicholas Schaffner is a book that I enjoy on a great many levels. And I think Schaffner is an excellent writer. I think he has good insight and he does try to provide a works cited of sorts, but he's publishing in the late 70s. And because he's publishing in the late 70s, there is an enormous amount of primary sources that he did not have access to. And because of that, he's drawing flawed conclusions based on incomplete sources. So if a revised edition, or it wouldn't be revised because Schaffner has been gone for quite some time, if a re-edition of Schaffner was published, you know, next year, the issue would be you still have to pay attention to that original publication.
Paul makes the comment to Du Neuer, because Du Neuer makes the observation to Paul, and Paul is aware that, you know, he's gone over the material many, many times over the past, you know, 50 years. And Paul told Du Neuer that if, when in doubt, take my first version of it. Okay, he makes a point to Du Neuer, like, if I tell you subsequent stories or subsequent sort of versions of it, you probably should go with the first one I gave you, which I kind of thought was interesting, because I kind of didn't know if that was necessarily true all the time, depending on what he was talking about, right?
Right. I noted that too, that distinction or that general idea that Paul made or Paul gave regarding his changing versions of events. But back to the issue of chronology. So you have to pay addition, or sorry, you have to pay attention to the current publication date. You have to pay attention to the original publication date. But for a book like this, it's problematic because you can't look at the publication date of 2015 and think, oh, well, no, because it's Paul giving interviews to a sympathetic journalist and pushing his version of events. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few issues with that. Number one, many years from now is distinctive in that Paul gave the interviews with the acknowledgement that they were going to be turned into a book. Miles contacted McCartney and said, do you want to do a book? And Paul said, let's focus on the avant-garde. And Miles said, well, let's expand beyond that, do childhood, adolescence, and some other Beatles areas as well. Mm-hmm. But all of those interviews were given with Paul aware that they were going to be formed into a book, where you don't have that acknowledgement with the Du Neuer interviews. I'm mm-hmm. sure it may have occurred to Paul that it was a distinct possibility, but mm-hmm. that knowledge was not there. The other element that's going on is that you can't look many years from now 2.0 because some of these interviews predate many years from now, or they predate mm-hmm. Anthology or Salovich or the first interview that Du Neuer did with McCartney in 79. John is still alive.
Yeah.
So you have very different events unfolding in Beatles history at different times as Paul is giving these interviews over the decades and over the years in Paul's personal life, in Beatles history, in Beatles historiography, differing narratives that are going to crop up and emerge. And so the issue with this book is that you have to take each interview in its own particular context. And that is complicated by the reality that, what was the term Du Neuer used? Remixed the interviews? Problem is that you'll read an interview, and a few times Du Neuer will tell you this came from the 89 interview or this came from the 79 interview, but the bulk of the time he doesn't do that. And so it's very frustrating to me that we don't know when.
Because the context is confusing. He's almost recontextualizing it without your knowledge, kind of thing.
Yes. And I'm sure that we can go back and find the original copies of these interviews. Mm-hmm. But it's frustrating because the information isn't even in the back either.
Hmm.
You can't flip back to the bibliography, because that's what I did when I finished the book, and see, does he have the citations for these interviews? And he does not. So you don't know whether he's melding the interviews together. It's sort of like, and this just occurred to me, it's sort of like Anthology, where you have these pages, the Anthology book, I mean to say, where you have these pages of interviews from John or George or Ringo or Paul, and they're welding together interviews from 71 to 64 to 83.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of a Frankenstein monster of interviews.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the, that was probably the most serious problematic issue I found in regards to this book, is not knowing when a particular interview was given and not knowing what editing was done to these interviews.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to go too far off track. So those are the areas of chronology to pay attention to, both in general in regards to the original publication date mm-hmm. and also in regards to this particular book. But beyond that, you also have to categorize by narrative. Where mm-hmm. does this book or any book fall in the historiography of its subject? And again, publication date can be a guide, but it's not the end all be all when it comes to where a book falls. Just because a book is published during a time when a particular narrative is dominant does not mean that that book supports that dominant narrative. And we've seen this in Beatles historiography. We have George Martin in 1979 publishing All You Need Is Ears. And in that, he rejects one of the major elements of the Lennon Remembers narrative, that John and Paul were not equal. because Martin flat out says, yes, they were. And you can't divide the two of them like that and say this one was more important and this one was less important. It's impossible to do. So Martin is very explicitly rejecting one of the major platforms of the Lenin Remembers narrative at the tail end of the Lenin Remembers narrative in 1979. And if there were a book published 2 weeks from now that advocated every major aspect of the Shout narrative, it would still be considered a part of the Shout narrative, even though it would be published during the time period when the Lewison narrative is dominant.
Oh, that's interesting. Wow. Yeah.
So having said all that, and mm-hmm. probably overcomplicated the issue, Dunoyer falls.
But it shows how it's not linear, though, right? Like,
no, it's not.
That's a good example of how historiography is not linear, because something is written in this time period, but it's published in another time period. Yeah.
But yeah, now looking at this book, it's very simple because Dunoyer, both chronologically and in terms of interpretation, mm-hmm. falls squarely under Lewis' narrative, and he rejects the Lenin Remembers narrative and the Shout narrative.
Yeah.
He argues on the two major debates. Number one, no one is solely or primarily to blame for the breakup, mm-hmm. although I guess you could argue that if Dunoyer identifies anyone who is primarily to blame for the breakup, it's Alan Klein.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
it's not Paul McCartney yeah. or any of the other yeah. Beatles in particular. But also, he also explicitly rejects the aspect of the Lenin Remembers and the Shout narrative that John and Paul were not equals no. and was not a complementary mm-hmm. partnership. In fact, I'm trying to remember what his quote is, because it is a very strong rejection of that.
Yeah.
And I.
Yeah. Aaron, before we go too much into that, can we talk just a few minutes about what I thought was pretty unique in Dunoyer's book, which is discussing Paul as an interview subject?
Well, just a minute, because we actually have one more category to go through.
Oh, sorry. No, okay, I'm jumping ahead. Go ahead.
You'd think we'd be done, but no, there's a whole bunch of categories to go through. And this is the last one.
Okay.
And this is essentially assigning a work into a subcategory under the larger subject area of the Beatles. And how this works is, you take a book and you compare and contrast the evidence and interpretations in that book with similar books under the same historiography. And an example of that would be, if your overall subject is the American Civil War, you're not going to take a book on, let's say, immigrant soldiers in the Union Army. At one point, 40% of the Union Army was made up of immigrant soldiers. And compare and contrast the primary sources in there, the interpretations in there, the debates in that particular subject with a biography of John Wilkes Booth. Because there's going to be virtually no overlap mm-hmm. in those sources and in those interpretations. So what you would do instead is you would take that book on immigrant soldiers in the Union Army and compare and contrast it with the evidence and the interpretations on a book that studies the immigrant experience in the Confederate military, or the immigrant experience in that same time period, only the civilian experience as opposed to the military experience, because that's where you're going to see overlap in sources, and that's where you're going to see similar debates that are being waged. So for a book like this in Beatles history, which is basically a series of interviews with Paul McCartney, you're not going to take the evidence in this and the interpretations in this and compare and contrast it with Rupert Perry's Northern Songs, which is a history of the Northern Songs Company, the Lennon McCartney Songwriting Catalog Company, because they're not going to have that sort of primary source or interpretive or debate overlap.
Okay.
So what you do with this book then is you figure out what subcategory it falls into. And in Beatles historiography, you would take this book and compare and contrast it with, let's say, well, many years from now.
Yeah, many years from now.
With that distinction that many years from now was known from day one that it was going to be a book. Also, let's see, Salavich or Ray Coleman. Ray Coleman's Yesterday and Today, McCartney Yesterday and Today, would also fall under this category. And some other books that are very heavily reliant on these McCartney interviews.
Okay, yeah.
But yes, now we finally reached the end of categorizing. Okay. But those are the areas of primary versus secondary source, chronology, narrative, and subcategory that you really have to do with every single book.
Okay. And what does that mean for the average Beatle fan who's reading a book and thinking, oh, this doesn't jive with this other book I read? You know, you get a lot of that, right, in Beatle fandom, where you get so many competing bits of information and contrasting information. Does it make sense then to just to remind people that you do have to make comparisons in the manner you describe, that would be the best way of being able to do that and do it, you know, accurately?
That's what I was taught.
in a phrase. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to talk about the part of the book where Dunoyer discusses Paul as an interview subject.
Yeah. Just before we kind of get more in depth into the key areas that we thought Dunoyer did spend some time on that you wanted to sort of highlight. I thought that I don't recall reading a Beatle biography where the author spent so much specific time discussing the interview subject as a subject. And I thought that was kind of a standout part of the book. And I thought provided sort of a window into Paul's sort of personality that it kind of is implied in other books. And, you know, you kind of get that sense yourself when you see interviews or you read interviews. But can we just kind of briefly kind of highlight some of the things that Dunoyer talked about? He said that he thought Paul was very tolerant of interviewers. He tended to ask them about themselves, which is apparently rare that he would. It was just part of setting up a conversation versus an interview. And Paul's need to be an interview in an interview versus a sort of a formal Q&A. He said that Paul hates to look, quote, remote or grand and always took pains to be informal. He likes to be spoken to in the same informal way that he speaks to others. So Dunoyer structured the interview as conversations, not as interrogations. He described Paul as a confident speaker who knew how to control his interviews without being dominating or probably obvious about it. Whenever he wanted to steer away from something disagreeable, Paul could be, he said, chattily discursive. And it wasn't always easy to interrupt him. He said, and I thought this was really interesting, he said Paul tends to overuse modifiers and qualifiers, something that he himself had noted when he reads transcripts of his own interview. So, for example, he gave the example of the Beatles were a great little band.
Yes.
And that was something that was, everybody I think has commented on that in fandom, I think. And that, when I mentioned earlier that when discussing subjects had already been discussed, that Paul counseled Dunoyer to take his earliest version as the best version. So that was some of my little notes about that.
Probably what I found most interesting of Paul Dunoyer's comments on that was the acknowledgement that McCartney has given more interviews than the interviewer has conducted.
Yeah.
And nothing is new to him in an interview. You are not going to catch him off guard. You have the whole Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours of practice to become a master at something. I would assume that McCartney has given more interviews than perhaps any person alive. He has to be.
Yeah.
So I just thought that element there's a power imbalance. There's really no way to not acknowledge that. And Dunoyer talks about that too. in that, again, McCartney wants a conversation, and he doesn't want the person sitting across from him to be an awestruck Chris Farley.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it is difficult for the interviewer, particularly in the first interviewers, to get over their own awe at the reality that they are sitting in a room with history.
Yeah. And Denoyer made that comment about himself too. Yes. In his first interviews, yeah, with Paul. Yeah. And it's interesting, sort of the control dimension, the power and control dimension, because Paul doesn't want to appear. He wants it to be an easy conversation, but clearly he wants to be in control of it, and he can be, and he is. And he tends to, and I've noticed in other sort of interviews, just, you know, television interviews, that when they, especially American interviewers, tend to take the sort of 60 minutes, 2020 type style of interrogation, he doesn't look comfortable. He doesn't like it. And he kind of gives you the same old, you know, formulas of, you know, where the more conversational it is, the more he's likely to engage, but he's still in control.
Right. And part of that simply goes back to the fact that he is granting the interview. Now, he's an old hand at doing PR, and he knows that you don't bite the hand that feeds you. Now, you also have Denoyer saying that Paul does enjoy challenging questions. Mm-hmm. I can't remember if that was the exact phrase. But, and I believe we have something to that effect from Lewison as well. An interview Lewison has given within the last, I'm not sure how many years, that Paul will give good answers when he is asked good questions.
Yeah. Yeah. Or else it's formulaic if you don't.
Absolutely. And something else to keep in mind with Denoyer is, because we have these interviews that span throughout the decades, you might, again, read the book in 2015 and say, oh, well, Paul said this in Anthology, and he said this in Many Years From Now, and he's just repeating himself. But if the interview predates those things, then Denoyer may have been the first to get that statement from Paul. And it just wasn't compiled into the book until now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just a few other things I just wanted to kind of draw a line under. Denoyer talks a lot about Paul's image as a PR man, and mm-hmm. how that's always perceived kind of in negative tones. And he has a different take on it. And he sees Paul as just handling everything with, he calls it practice ease and winning self-effacement.
I think that's an interesting issue, because it is an element that has a great deal of truth to it, because we do have various Beatles insiders who attested to Paul's ability and willingness to be the band's PR guy.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you also have the reality that I've noted on other podcasts, that Paul's PR ability fails him significantly when we're in the midst of the breakup. And I believe mm-hmm. Denoyer notes that as well.
Yeah.
Talking about that, if ever there was a time when Paul's PR would have helped, that would have been it.
And that would have been the time, yeah.
Produced little to nothing of significance. And that certainly damaged his reputation and contributed to the dominance of the Lennon Remembers narrative. So I think it's a very interesting aspect, because I think there is a great deal of truth to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think certain authors have simplified it, vastly simplified it, to the point that many people view it in an inaccurate way.
Yeah. I'm just reading a quote here from Denoyer. He says, from the earliest days, Paul was noted for diplomacy, especially when set against the abrasive Lennon. But diplomats are mistrusted for their guile as much as they may be praised for tact or sensitivity to the feelings of others. I've never found Paul to be the calculating PR man that detractors allege. And he said, he references the It's a Dre comment about John's murder is hardly the calculated response quote of a PR man. So Denoyer has a very different take on that than do other writers and biographers.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting element. Certainly that image of Paul as a PR guy valid or not valid, has played a very significant role in how people view him.
And the last thing, Aaron, before we move on to, because I know you wanted to talk more length about, a greater length about Paul's view of Alan Klein, just a little kind of a pop-up comment that jumped out at me when Paul was talking about the fans and the largely female fandom. And he was asked by Denoyer whether the hysteria scared them and they were nervous about their fame and stuff. And Paul says, quote, "We used to say it's just the same as guys going to football matches. This is like the girls' equivalent. They throw things and they'd scream for their team. It just makes a different noise with girls." And I know you and I, we've talked on the blog about the perception of Beatle fandom, the female fandom, is being a little more sort of pejorative than, you know, than if they were male fans, you know, carrying on. So I thought Paul's perception of that was pretty progressive.
I thought so too. I think that's an interview he gave after he had a few daughters.
Yeah, because he just referenced going to a girl's soccer game or his daughter's soccer game or something and hearing all the screaming. Yeah, I think there was a reference there to that.
And I think that's a quote, I believe, that Christine Feldman Barrett has in her book that I discussed with her for FabForCon. And I think it's, again, a progressive evaluation of basically equating the emotional and verbal response of male fans at sporting events with the emotional and the verbal response of female fans at Beatles concerts. There is a level of hysteria, frankly, that you get at sporting events. I have been to Kansas Stadium, and at times there is a level of hysteria, whether it's good hysteria or whether it's crushing disappointment. It is there, and it is an emotionally driven response.
Yeah.
So the problem has been that there are some authors, particularly male authors, who look at the emotion involved with the reaction of female Beatles fans and imply or flat out state that because it's emotionally driven, it's less significant or intelligent or valid than the reaction of male fans. But as has been argued by Christine and in other areas, and as Paul is implying here, there's really no difference between the reaction of a male fan at a sporting event and the reaction of a female fan at a Beatles concert.
Yeah. Yeah. Did we want to turn our attention now to a more lengthy discussion about Alan Klein and the perceptions of Alan Klein's involvement with Paul McCartney and the Beatles in general?
Yes. The most interesting interviews to me in this entire book were the ones where Paul is discussing Klein. And we were just talking about how Paul is addicted to qualifiers and modifiers. And what is interesting is that those are largely absent from his descriptions of Klein, not just in his interviews with Denoyer, but really across the board. I believe in my notes for many years from now, when I was working on my book, I said something to the effect of, the one individual in Beatles historiography about whom McCartney is unfailingly negative is Alan Klein.
Yeah, he's unequivocal about that. There's no qualifiers there. None.
Right. I think the most positive thing we have on record from Paul on Klein is that comment after they signed one of the contracts, and Paul says something to the effect of, "Well, Alan, if you're screwing us over, I don't see how you're doing it."
Yeah.
And that's hardly, you know, a resounding endorsement.
Yeah.
But what we have here is a little bit, but I wanted to read some of the quotes of what Paul has to say to Denoyer regarding Klein. And fair warning, there's at least one derogatory term in here. In a nutshell, this guy came in to rob the Beatles.
Yeah, I got that too. Yeah. And he calls him that certain businessman. He doesn't even want to refer to him by name.
"And I spotted the burglar. Nobody else did. They rather liked this guy, and they welcomed him. I had the choice of busting the burglar or allowing him to take everything from the house. It was a shitty time for me. The only option was to either let him take it all and all of us just swim along with him. But the truth of the matter is that he was a total cunt.
Yeah.
And he goes on and on in this vein. Mm-hmm. And you also see this in Many Years From Now, and you see this in numerous other interviews that Paul has given regarding the breakup and regarding Klein. Mm-hmm. But if you focus particularly on these interviews, then there are three major elements to what Paul is saying regarding Klein. And the first is what he said in the quote that I just read. Klein was a thief. Klein was a burglar. He was a con man, however you want to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, the second element to this, is that of all four Beatles, Paul was the only one who was capable of recognizing this, that mm-hmm. Klein was a thief. And not only that, because there's another layer that Paul emphasizes in these particular interviews. Not only was he the only one, he claims, who was capable of seeing that Klein was a thief, but also he seems to argue that he was the only one who was capable of viewing Klein with any level of objectivity.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives an example of after Klein had signed with the Beatles, that Klein told John, George, and Ringo, I want a 20% commission. And so the others go to Paul and say, Klein says he wants 20%. We're going to give him 20%. And Paul's response is, we're the Beatles. We are the biggest band on the face of the earth. He didn't help build us up from the ground up. He came in when we were at the very top of the mountain. Offer mm-hmm. him 15%. He'll take it, or we'll negotiate and go halfway, you know, 17 mm-hmm. and a half. Mm-hmm. He gives a little, we give a little. And the others respond, no, Klein says he wants 20%. So we're going to give him 20%.
Yeah.
And so some of the language Paul uses in these interviews is interesting. And I can't remember a specific word that he uses in these interviews, but I do remember in Many Years From Now, he says the other three were utterly besotted.
Yes, yes.
Klein. And that's a very interesting
and Klein, term. Just to interrupt, Klein calls Paul the reluctant virgin.
Yes, it's a very yeah. charged vocabulary. The implication from Paul is basically that the others had a massive crush on Klein.
Mm-hmm.
Not romantic or sexual, but that they were gripped in this irrational emotional attachment to Klein to the point that not only could they not see what Paul believed that he was a that they simply could not view him with any objectivity until it was far too late.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting because certainly one of the major arguments that was made against Paul in the breakup period is that he was the one who was too emotionally invested in the Eastmans to be mm-hmm. able to view yeah. Klein rationally. And one of the terms that the press uses in describing Paul's refusal to accept Klein as manager is irrational. And mm-hmm. Paul is implying a counterargument that the others were not choosing Klein for rational or objective reasons. They were choosing Klein because of emotional ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And you also have a twist to that in, I believe, his November 1971 Melody Maker interview, where Paul argues that for the other three Beatles, Klein is this magical combination of father figure who keeps promising, I will protect you, I will take care of you, my only goal in life is to serve you, and magical genie, where yeah. whatever they ask for, whatever they want, Klein will get it for them.
Mm-hmm.
You have that element of, in Paul's view of Klein in these interviews, number one, that mm-hmm. Klein was a, number two, that Paul was the only one who was capable of seeing that Klein was a thief. And number three, we get to the issue of the lawsuit against John, George, and Ringo to remove Klein as the head of Apple and appoint a receiver to monitor the band's finances. And what's interesting about this is that in these interviews, Paul repeatedly says if he hadn't launched the lawsuit, that the Beatles would have lost everything. And again, there aren't qualifiers and there aren't modifiers. He explicitly says repeatedly, mm-hmm. legally, financially, they would have lost everything. I am not a lawyer and I am not an expert in finance. And I really don't know that much about the business history of other bands beyond the Beatles. So I'm asking an honest question. How possible is that? In some alternate universe where the Beatles, or not the Beatles, but Paul doesn't launch the lawsuit or loses the lawsuit and Klein retains his position as the head of Apple, could they have lost everything? The problem with that is that when I see an absolutist term, everything, never, always, that usually raises alarm bells.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's rarely as absolute as all that. Having said that, Klein certainly would have had significantly more influence and power had he remained head of Apple.
Mm-hmm.
I just find it a rather dubious claim that the Beatles could have lost everything financially.
Well, my question about that too is he talking only financially or is he talking in terms of the reputation? It is an all-encompassing statement. He's talking about money and they had money concerns at the time. But to me, it always struck me if we're, you know, armchair analyzing what he meant, you know, it struck me as that he was talking about a lot more than just money.
And that didn't occur to me. So, but it's a very good point and a very good angle because one of the things Paul talks about in these interviews, he's very defensive about launching the lawsuit. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But one of the things he does, and again, if you're comparing and contrasting what he says in these interviews with something like many years from now, in many years from now, Paul talks about the lawsuit and says that without it, or excuse me, let me go back. In these interviews, Paul says, if I hadn't done the lawsuit, we wouldn't have had Anthology. And we wouldn't have had the Beatles Love, and we wouldn't have had Number One or any of those things. Those projects only happened because I made sure that Klein was not in charge.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go back to many years from now, you have Paul discussing the aftermath of an Apple meeting when George was still alive, and the issue of the lawsuit comes up, and I don't know what context, and Paul doesn't explain what context. And George makes a casual little comment regarding the lawsuit. Oh, yeah, thanks for that, by the way. And
yeah.
Paul grumbles in many years from now, that's what I got for saving the Beatles' fortunes was a tepid thanks for that, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And many years from now, he says that's the only acknowledgement or the only thank you he got for launching the lawsuit. But then you get to these interviews and other interviews that Paul has given throughout the last few years. And in those interviews, Paul claims that everyone has come up to him, including Yoko. He deliberately name checks Yoko, has come up to him and said, thank you, you did the right thing when you launched the lawsuit. So I am guessing that sometime post many years from now, you had Ringo and Yoko come up to Paul and offer that, or he's getting confused because
yeah.
He very explicitly says in many years from now, that was the only time I got it. Again, you have this time gap because I think the interviews where he's talking about the thanks from Yoko and Ringo regarding the lawsuit and the acknowledgement that it was the right thing to do have come more recently. What also interests me about Paul's claim, if I hadn't launched the lawsuit, we would have lost everything, is that that's not what he's said in previous interviews and in previous eras.
Mm-hmm.
Because what Paul's saying regarding the lawsuit in 70 and 71, and this is in the few interviews he's giving in this time period, as well as in the court documents in this time period, is the Beatles are broken beyond repair. Even though they're broken and they're not getting back together, mm-hmm. I'm stuck under the management of a man I don't trust and I don't want as manager. Mm-hmm. He has too much control over my finances and too much control over my music. And the only way for me to get out of his management mm-hmm. is to sue John, George, and Ringo.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what he's saying in 70 and 71. And then you fast forward to, again, Joan Goodman and the Playboy interview. And what he's saying there is he adds an emotional element to it, because that's the interview where he really first addresses the emotional crisis he went through following the breakup of the band.
Yeah.
And now he's saying, I went through a nervous breakdown. I wasn't shaving. I wasn't washing. I was laying in bed all day. I was drinking all the time. I wasn't sleeping. And when I was sleeping, I was having nightmares of Alan Klein chasing me with a dentist drill.
Yeah.
And the only way I could get out of this depression, this near nervous breakdown, is by gaining control of my life. And the only way to do that was to get out from under Alan Klein's management. So he adds an emotional element in those interviews that he hadn't had in 1970 yeah. and 71. And the interesting thing about these varying versions of why he launched the lawsuit is that they're not necessarily mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
They can coexist. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting how his reasoning shifts over the decades. One of the elements that comes back again in interviews when Paul is discussing this time period is the lack of control. Mm-hmm. His lack of control over his music, his lack of control over his legal and financial situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have other interviews where Paul tends to talk about control quite a bit. It tends to be something that matters to him. There's even an interview where he talks about he eventually enjoyed being bass player because it gives you a level of control over the rest of the band. Or he enjoys horse riding because it gives you a level of control.
Yeah.
Over the
animal. Yeah.
So I think that issue of control is evidently quite important to him.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially as an artist. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And just one more thing before we wrap up. I liked how Du Neuer ended with an interview that he did with Linda in 79 and talked about her method of interviewing. He notes how when she got agitated or when she was nervous, her New York accent would creep back in.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little more hard-edged, and just talks about how she was a nervous interviewer, talks about the perception of her, again, the Wallace Simpson, the American gold digger who swept in and snared England's most eligible bachelor.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a great moment that really humanizes Linda, where Du Neuer asks her what she misses about New York, and she says, pizza. This is 1979. I don't know what, you know, the status of English pizza was in 79, but probably wasn't
clearly
great.
Not up to her standards. One thumb up, one thumb down. How would you categorize this book as a historian?
The issue of not including the citations or the specific dates for the interviewers and melding them together is very problematic to me. And the reality that we don't have that information even in the bibliography of the book is problematic to me.
Okay.
The element that's somewhat out of Du Neuer's control, that much of the information in these interviews is not new, is also not necessarily Du Neuer's fault,
mm-hmm.
but the cliche, of course, is if you've read one Paul McCartney interview, you've read 50 of them.
Mm-hmm.
So there isn't all that much new material in here.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not something that is going to change a pre-existing narrative. Now, mm-hmm. having said that, I do think that the strongest and the lengthiest interview that Du Neuer did with McCartney is the 89 World Tour booklet. And that, I believe, is the beginning of Paul's PR push to revise the Lenin Remembers and the Shout narratives.
Yeah.
So just because it's all Frankensteined together, that makes it difficult. I do think it's a good book. I don't think it could be qualified as an essential book in Beatles historiography. It is definitely one that, as we said, argues against the Lenin Remembers and the Shout narratives, seems to fall firmly under the Lewison interpretation of the breakup and of the Lennon-McCartney songwriting partnership and the Lennon-McCartney friendship.